Jazz Whitehead in for Mark Steiner here on the Mark Steiner Show. We're going to shift the focus just a bit and use a wider lens to take a look at what is happening around the country. It is time for our cultural roundtable. And to discuss, we're going to have the Black Girls Matter movement, Caitlyn Jenner, representations of trans women in the media, the death of Maya Hall, the transgender woman who was killed outside of the NSA on March 30th, the events in McKinney, Texas, the suicide of Khalif Browder. We have a lot to talk about today, and we have a power-packed studio to talk about it. First, we have Reverend Merrick Moise, who's an ordained minister, a writer, a community activist and teacher, and one of the first African-Americans ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore. Welcome. That's a handful.
It's a lot.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us, Merrick. Dr. Bynum is here. She's an assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University. Thank you for joining us. Hello. Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Hey. Love the Poet, my favorite poet, indie spoken word artist and musician, and she's the author of Black Marks on White Paper. Welcome back, love.
Thank you for having me.
And last but definitely not least is Kalima Young. She's the director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Welcome, Kalima.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. This is a hot day, and there are a lot of topics that we're going to discuss. 410-319-8888. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner and at KYHit. Jump on our Facebook page or just go to steinershow.org. Reverend Merrick, let's start with you. There are people who are calling for another uprising. That happened in Mount Vernon this weekend. You had Mount Vernon saying, let's have another uprising. You have Cherry Hill saying, we need to have more prayer. You're a reverend. Tell me, how do we connect another uprising to having more prayer? Where do we go from here to turn this city around?
I think that the thing we need to think about is the uprising prayerful, right? Mm. So what does that look like? Does that look like people burning and looting? I hope not. Does it look like people walking in silence while African drums are playing? What does that look like? Does that look like an uprising where people decide not to spend any money on a certain day of the week or for a week? There are many ways to have an uprising. But I also think it's important that people understand that we're not railing against people, that this is about systems. So it takes a multifaceted approach. I mean, one protest won't do it, but there needs to be a programmatic focus in place, that there are different actors positioned in different parts of the system to literally be the cancer that eats away at the system to create a system of justice and equity for people.
Love, I want to come to you because I know you use a lot of social media. Mm-hmm. And maybe one way to connect all these protests is through Twitter, through Facebook. Do you think that we need to have multiple movements happening across the country in order to bring about some real change?
No.
No,
I think we need to have one movement across the country in order to bring about some change. One of the things that I noticed at the 50th anniversary march on Washington was that there were so many different movements that I was confused as to what I was hearing. Like every 10 minutes, another speaker was speaking about something else. Mm. And the underlying thing here is that we all have there's several injustices, but we have a group of people who are constantly the victim of those injustices. We have people who need to, I don't want to say be led, because in this situation there can be not one leader. You know, taking from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee idea, like teach the young people, teach somebody how to teach everybody else how to protest against a certain thing that's going on. You know what I mean? Like everybody, there's leaders everywhere. We all need to come together in some way. And we can use social media that way, but I don't think there needs to be several different movements. Everybody should be on one accord.
So maybe one issue after the other.
Right.
In sequence,
exactly.
Rather than everything.
Right. Okay? But that should all come together to accomplish one goal.
Which leads us kind of into our next question, Dr. Bynum, where we're talking about the Black Lives Matter movement. I think at this point, everybody knows what Black Lives Matter means. I mean, it was talked about on Empire by Patti LaBelle. You have folks in Ethiopia yelling Black Lives Matter. It's on every T-shirt, every sticker, bumper sticker. Like, we know what that means. But there's a concern that when you say Black Lives Matter, people immediately think about black boys and black men, that you don't think about black girls. So how do we broaden up this campaign for Black Lives Matter and really piggyback the Say Her Name campaign and make it into one movement? Or can we do that, or should we?
Well, you know, I think that I have to admit that I kind of struggle with with Black Lives Matter as the statement, you know, I think that mm-hmm. it's so, in some ways, to me, it's such an obvious statement of fact that I don't necessarily yes. know how to turn it into something that is actionable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so Black Lives Matter, yes.
Mm-hmm. now okay. what, right?
They always have.
they always have. Right. And I think that Black people in particular have always known that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we necessarily need to be reminded of it. So what concerns me is not so much how do we include Black girls and women, but instead how do we actually make a statement that does the work that Love just mentioned, that is definitive enough that we can have actionable items, that we can encompass multiple kinds of movements.
Kaleem, I wanted to ask you, just to piggyback very quickly before our break on Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. well, people push that to All Lives Matter. Do we need to just take that away as a whole?
I think that the All Lives Matters, I saw a really great quote. When you have a bunch of people working and trying to stop cancer, you don't interrupt and say, oh, yeah, but other people get cancer, too. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. like Black Lives Matter is steeped specifically in focusing on the inequities that are impacting Black people's lives. Mm-hmm. So turning it into All Lives Matters really does water down that particular statement. And I agree with both of you. It's like Black people know. We know we matter. We know we're human. We've been saying that from Jump Street. Like, you can't mess with that. However, I think that watering the statement down even further to All Lives Matter is a way of distracting from the actual issue, which is anti-Blackness, which is prevalent around mm-hmm. the world.
Because there's a disconnect that some are arguing about for Black women. Mm-hmm. The African American Policy Forum noted that there's always something that connects with Black men. So you wear the hoodie, we know we're talking about Trayvon. You put your hands up, we're talking about, you know, what Mike Brown did in the last few minutes. If you say, I can't breathe, you think of Eric Garner. But there is no thing we have to connect us to the tragic incidents that are happening with Black women. What can we do to expand, to get people to think about what's happening to Black girls and Black women? Dr. Bynum, and then Love, I want you to talk about that as well.
I guess we have to remember that violence can look like many different things. And unfortunately, I think that with the images that you've just invoked, the end result is death. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to understand. Those men were killed. Mm-hmm. And to see it, to imagine it, and to understand the end result of it. And I guess what I wonder about in kind of the history of violence against Black women, I'm not sure that the end result is always death in a way that's sensationalizable and marketable. You know, I think that there are many other violences that happen to Black women in particular that are just as horrific and potentially more traumatic because the end result may not be a death. It may just be a gross violation of the body. And I think that there's no, you can't turn that into a hoodie.
Right.
You know, you can't turn that into, into hands up, don't shoot. Mm-hmm. You know, that ends up being a bit more complicated. And I think that for this movement in particular at times, it's really about the marketability of it. Exactly. It's about being able to create a hashtag. You can't have a hashtag that says, don't pin me to the ground, I'm in my bikini. Oh. You know, like that's too long.
Yeah, that's
so,
way too long.
Right.
So I think that will not fit on a T-shirt.
Yeah, it won't fit on a T-shirt.
There's also something very disturbing when I see young boys, I think of my own sons, wearing the I Can't Breathe T-shirts. Mm. There's something very disturbing about knowing that the end result of I Can't Breathe, happened twice, is somebody dying. Mm. Love, you know, this whole idea, you were saying that maybe for women, the next thing is you got to wear the bikini.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening with the Black female body, which is a conversation that's been happening for years.
Yeah, we were actually talking about that before we came on the air, about how, you know, we are, as Black women, exoticized, you know what I mean, in many aspects. And we're going to talk a little bit about the what just happened in McKinney, Texas. But we were talking about how we felt like his choice, Merrick was saying, his choice to get the one girl in the bikini.
Right.
What did that mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we're going to delve into that. But I did want to touch on the idea that Black girls are an at-risk youth. I worked with at-risk youth for like 9 years out of college. And I did my thesis I went to Coppin State than college now, university. I'm repping right now. But my
as Kalima raises right her fist
yes,
in support.
Boom,
yes.
Yes.
HBCUs.
Yes, we in here. But I did my thesis on the about the disproportionate amount of rehabilitative services and programs for girls versus boys. Mm-hmm. I worked as an intern at the Department mm-hmm. of Juvenile Justice, then services now. And it was the drug court unit. And that was for boys, mm-hmm. black boys. I mean, because typically in Baltimore City, the average you look are brown right. people. And so they ultimately, I ultimately came to the conclusion that it costs more to fund programs for girls. And the reason why is because when somebody finally realizes that a young girl has issues, it's so far gone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because a young boy who has certain types of issues will act out a certain way and somebody will catch it. That's not what boys do. Or you be a man, you know, get it together. What's wrong with you? Mm. You know, for a girl, oh, she's a girl. She's just crazy. Women have issues. You know, out of the womb, we're yeah. just, we just have problems. Yeah. So we're just going to overlook it. But she's being raped every day.
Mm. Mm. Or the end result ends up being dramatically different. So
exactly.
A boy, worst case scenario, just ends up incarcerated
exactly.
because he's, I don't know, fighting in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A girl could be reproducing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and, having
and having babies.
So how do you create a program that's like, don't stop.
Right. And then they had the FIT unit, right. the female intervention team unit. I don't know if that's still active, but those things, the services that right. they have to implement, the amount of therapy visits, the meds, whatever it is that they choose to do, at the point where they realize that the young girl has serious issues, it costs lots of money for one girl, mm-hmm. more so than what they would, because they catch it sooner with boys.
Right.
And then they do something to help them. And they send them back into the streets. I don't know if it's because the ultimate goal is to incarcerate them later. I don't know, right. because that's a business as well.
Right, right.
So you know what I mean?
You send them back because, you know, eventually you'll have them back. Right.
You know, so then that there are a lot of underlying questions there. But I think that it's just in our country, a very patriarchal society, dealing with women, especially black women, who are at the bottom of the totem pole, if you look at the way our country mm-hmm. works.
Right.
That is everybody's last thought, and their first thought is, oh, black women can deal with anything.
Exactly.
They're strong right. out the womb.
It's that Zora Neale Hurston idea that we are the mules
right.
of the world. That's the same concept.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. And that's what I think that is the root of the issue as to why we're constantly overlooked, because we're constantly looking up and paying attention to everybody else. Nobody is looking down to catch us mm-hmm. or to watch or see how we're walking.
Now, this actually leads us right into what happened in McKinney, Texas. Kalima, can you talk a little bit about that, kind of outline what happened, and then talk about some of the greater implications of this?
Well, my understanding is that there's a pool party that lots of young people went to this pool party in an area that was mostly white, mm-hmm. am I correct? Mm-hmm. And there was an altercation between one woman, a white woman, who was saying racist things to the young people who were right. in the pool, mm-hmm. and an older black woman around 19 years old approached that woman and told her to stop talking that way to all of the young people. They had an altercation, and that started a fight, mm-hmm. and the authorities were called in. And when the authorities were called in, everyone ran, because what happens when the po-po comes?
People right. run.
You
people
run because people die. And in the midst of that, there was a police officer who many are seeing. And if you watch the viral video, you'll see that mm-hmm. he was extremely aggressive. He pulled his gun on teenagers, and he also tackled a young girl who's 14 years old in a bikini to the ground and sat on her
right.
as she called for her mother.
Oh, that's painful.
And this image, this video, has been shot across the mm-hmm. world, and it's become viral. And once again, the image of black pain is spectacle for other people's enjoyment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It keeps being shared. Everyone's seeing it. We all feel that moment of outrage. Oh, my gosh, how can this happen? We all know mm-hmm. how this happens. And the continual repetitiveness of these images mm-hmm. did not move us forward. They continue to numb people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it becomes something, a quick meme, a thing that you can see and then you can push away and take away. Mm-hmm. Because we're so inclined, we have such a valency in this world to take on the spectacle of black pain and just see it and expect it and actually not be actionable and not move it forward. And I think that's what happens in these social media spaces. This is what happens in these viral images that are being pushed out. And we are not being tasked with actually sitting in the pain and actually unpacking it and looking at the nuances. We see the pain. We're used to seeing the pain. It gets passed on and we move on to the next thing.
Absolutely. Which what we're going to do. We want to unpack this pain. Yeah. Reverend Merrick, I'm going to come to you and then we'll get to a phone call before I go to Love. How do we begin to unpack this pain? Because I think Kalima tapped on something here, that once again, you know, the image of black pain is a spectacle for other people's enjoyment, in a sense. What do you think, Robin?
I think that one of the things we need to do is talk about it. We need to dialogue about it. And we need to be very cognizant of what was actually at play there. Mm-hmm. I know when we talked in the green room about it, mm-hmm. I noticed this big white man with a gun literally pulling on this child's hair, putting her face to the grass, and then sitting on her back, and she's in a bikini. Yeah. So I immediately went to sexual assault.
Right.
Exactly.
And I don't know. I thought I was the only one. I was like, because I didn't hear that chatter in social media, and then in dialogue in the green room, these sisters said, well, we kind of saw that too.
So
what does that look like when over and over and over again, this is ancestral. You know, so now we got to deal with how this has been since we got here. And I think that is the trauma that nobody wants to talk about. And we keep replaying these things. But on the other side, these white folks that are in these power structures, they're playing out their ancestral stuff, too. We need to be clear about that. Because he came in like gangbusters.
He rolled
like the slave catcher. And I was like, oh, you're doing a lot. And now you want to take down this young black woman.
14-year-old girl.
Right.
Also,
if you watch the video and pay attention to every player, the young white boy who is filming it, who ultimately was the one who uploaded it and spoke against it, he is all but ignored. But he's
says
filming it. He says that.
He's all but ignored. I'm invisible.
And then you see these very large, plain clothed citizens of the neighborhood, white men, who are now standing next to the police officer as his bodyguard after he has grabbed and dragged. We did not talk about how he dragged her across the grass after she was sitting just asking for her mother. He grabbed her and dragged her across the grass and put his knee in her. When he went to do that, two young black boys came to her aid. He turned, pulled his gun on them, and another two cops ran and chased them off. We have to think about, if we talk about ancestry, what we just saw in 2015 and how that would have played out in 1800s. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And everybody played a part in that scene.
And it seemed like everybody went back to their same roles.
And everybody went back to their same roles.
And in the end, there's a straight refusal to see it as sexual violence. Right. And I think that is one of that goes back to the conversation of how we make the turn the say her name movement and understand what violence looks like. Because when you watch that, you can see that it's sexual violence. You can understand it. But we have a refusal to see it as such. Mm-hmm. Unless somebody's being killed or choked to death, we refuse to see exactly what happens to black women.
Right.
And I feel like that's one of those examples in the media narrative of that piece as well.
Right. I want to get to a phone call here. We have Reverend Daka Napata, who wants to talk a little about injustice separating males and female. Welcome, Reverend. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. And my name is Daki Napata.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think it's that we do an injustice to ourselves when we begin to, as difficult as it is, to talk about whose pain is deeper. You know, it is no question that the type of violence, the type of poverty, and I'm so glad this is using the term ancestral, the ancestral heritage of this type of criminality and demonicness, you know, did not segregate itself between black men and black women or black boys or black girls. So even as the health policies that we obviously are challenged with making sure everybody gets taken care of, you know, I just think that we run a risk. I was listening to this sister earlier, and I clearly understand her talking about the type of resources that are portioned to young black females in particular.
Yes.
But when we look at the prison system in particular, And when we look at the demonic nature that they look at the third grade test scores of black males to decide how many prisons to build.
Yes.
I mean, that is more than demonic. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just saying, thank you for the discussion, but let us be very careful that as we talk about prioritizing the needs of black women or black men or whatever, that we not get into a play that's unconscious of who suffers more. Because this system is designed to stigmatize, to demonize, and dehumanize black life.
Thank you so much, Reverend. I wanted to have Kalima comment on that, and then I'm going to come to Dr. Bynum to continue our conversation about this issue of black pain as a spectacle for enjoyment.
I definitely agree with the caller that we also need to pay attention to anti-blackness in general. But by bringing up the issues of women, we are not invisibilizing the issues that impact men. Mm. We're not playing oppression Olympics. Mm. There's something in black. The black feminist movement that talks about if you have a clear understanding of anti-racism and anti-sexism, you have a road to liberation.
Mm.
And when we're talking about black women as the nexus to understand how anti-racism and anti-sexism and sexism play out, that is a vehicle with which we need to discuss and continue at and place at the forefront of our dialogue. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of like somebody's pain trumps another. It's a matter of being able to look at the intersections of mm-hmm. inequity and mm-hmm. see how those are playing out in the lives of women and how that creates a space for us to talk about liberation for all.
Right.
Now, we've seen this because once people started saying Black Lives Matter, then you had this pushback for All Lives Matter. Yeah. That is all of a sudden All Lives Matter just because we said Black Lives Matter.
Or when you said Black Girls Rock and white girls were like, well, why can't we have white girls rock? Well, because you were born told you rock.
Right.
You were born told that.
And oftentimes our ancestors who were raised in the house from the help said that you were rock.
Right. Exactly.
While she cradled this white girl.
You is good.
You is good.
You is good.
But what did she take home to her own children after her life was spent?
She took home to them, to her little boy, don't go across the street without looking this way or this way or that way. She took home social controls.
Stay invisible. Stay out the way.
Stay out of the way. She took home social controls, and now you have a community of people who are the most conservative in the world because they're nervous about walking across the street looking a certain type of way.
And that nervousness, of course, is rooted in some reality because we're seeing that play across the country.
Exactly.
That nervousness is rooted in something. Dr. Bynum, did you want to comment on this? This idea that, you know, I love the phrase Kalima used about the oppression Olympics, that it seems like whenever we focus our attention on trying to help one community, there's this pushback. No. You want to talk about black girls? Well, what about what's happening? You want to talk about, you know, Trayvon Martin? Well, what about the 61-year-old white man? What about him? As if we cannot even claim our own pain without opening it up for everyone. Well, like, what do we do with that? How do we begin to make some inroads with that?
Well, I think that to me, the problem is one of, like, literacy. Our ability to, like, quite literally read somebody else's pain and understand it. And I think, I mean, we've talked a lot about history, but I think that historically black pain has been illegible.
Right.
Well, Henry Box Brown has a quote in his narrative that's like, slaveholders assume that niggas have no feelings.
Unquote.
Can we just say that for CNN and everything?
I know.
Yeah, and I think that what becomes interesting is that Because the fight of black people is one for recognition, I think oftentimes activists and others who are trying to get that recognition, it have to play into the sensibilities of mainstream society. And mainstream society can't make sense of black people and their feelings. So what sells, what makes sense, is somehow, like I said before, the really obvious. Like, when someone dies, that makes sense. So I think for me, the oppression Olympics ends up reflecting more of our, like, the risk that's involved when we actually begin to make sense of someone else's experience.
I think what's interesting is that when we start talking about hashtag fatigue, Kalima talked a little bit about social media and sharing things on social media, from hashtag Trayvon to hashtag I can't breathe. Like, it is just one assault after the other. Mm-hmm. But this picture in McKinney, Texas really hit me in a very different way. I mean, I was very concerned with all of them. I cried about all of them. But that photo of the white police officer's knee
in the back
of this young girl laying face down, and she's calling not for her mother. She said, I'm calling for my mommy. Call my mommy.
Mm-hmm.
At 14 years old,
yeah.
Like that was a trigger for me. Like that is the picture that for me, I started weeping and wailing, going, there is no respect of the black female body at all. She has on very few clothes. She has a bikini on.
And she's then dragged across the grass and disregarded completely. And I do want to say this, though. We talked a little bit about this as we were walking in here. A very interesting dynamic. You had a group of older white people.
Yes.
Giving racial slurs to these young teenagers, talking about go back to Section 8, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the younger white people looking at them as if they had eight heads. What are you doing? Like, what, you know, actually saying, hey, no, what, this is not what we're going to be
because
doing.
Because they said we invited
we
them.
Invited
these are our guests.
These are our friends. These are
party.
Our friends.
Yes.
You know what I mean? From what I understand, very few of them actually jumped the fence. Most of them had guest passes. But kids jump fences.
All the time.
I don't care what you look like. You jump a fence at night to go to the pool knowing you shouldn't. You know what I mean?
This Ferris is
what,
Bueller's Day Off.
Thank you.
Yes.
I mean, yes, exactly. You know, things of this nature. Same as with the idea of, you know, riots and all these things. I mean, you go to University of Maryland, they lose a basketball game and they burn up their campus. But that's a whole nother topic.
Right. And then those are not looders.
Those aren't looters. But
yeah,
those
are just college kids.
They're just bad kids.
But,
you know, you have two or three kids who jump the fence or whatever. But I wanted to bring in the dynamic that there's a very different mindset with these young people.
Yes.
Like when I talk to my nieces about or my oldest niece about, you know, being gay and things like that when I told her about myself, you know, she was like, okay. And she's like, I said, do you have any friends that may be gay? And she said, yeah, I have a friend who's gay. You know, it's no big deal. We're good. What is it? What's the problem? And I'm like, what? She's like, what's the problem? You know, it doesn't translate the same. In 2015.
That's a very
with
good
young
point.
People.
Reverend Mayor, can you talk about that? Pull you back into the conversation. It seems like just based upon what Love is saying and also what happened this weekend, young people, beyond, younger than the millennials, right? We're talking now the ones who are in high school and
middle school,
seem to be a lot more advanced when it comes to thinking about race, thinking about gender, thinking about identity. So really, it's us old folks who need to, like, wander off in the desert so they can be free.
I think a lot of that has to do with when we talk about generations of unchurched people. So these children, by and large, have not received the level of programming that we have had. And oftentimes, to elevate consciousness, many of us have had to come out of those oppressive systems. Some of us have decided to stay in those systems to change the system from the inside. And some of us are wedded to the systems, particularly I'm talking about so-called traditional church systems and dogmatic Christian theology, because we have become slaves to those systems. So whether it's the white Jesus on the wall, and then by extrapolation our minds come to, well, all white people are divine, like this is a real thing that happens to people, to, you know, condemning someone for their gender identity or expression and or their sexual orientation. And so, you know, there was a very interesting thing around what happened with Caitlyn Jenner. Someone had a massive video where she basically read a lot of what's going on in community, because people congratulate Miss Jenner for being brave, but you just threw your nephew out on the street last week for being gay, or you are about to throw your daughter out because she has said that I'm trans or gender nonconforming. So how do we reconcile these things? Like, it was great for this white celebrity who has long money going back into the 70s,
right?
That continues to get residual checks, but Rashida and Rashad, y'all put out on the street. So I think that one of the things that we need to understand is when we steep ourselves in these theologies that no longer really bolster our humanity, what are we worshiping? Mm-hmm. Right. What are we dealing with? And we need to examine this in all spheres of faith, Christian and non-Christian, about how we're going to move forward to bolster people's humanity as opposed to strip them of it.
Well, I want to go to Dr. Bynum before we go to break. And when we come back from break, we're going to spend some time talking about Caitlyn Jenner, talk about what's happening in the trans community. But Dr. Bynum, if you can close this kind of Black Girls Matter, bringing attention to Black girls, if you can kind of close that conversation for us and kind of talk about where we go from here, it would be
and
wonderful.
Where
and
here.
Where we go from here. We want to talk about the past, present, and the future.
So I would say this first, that we are living in a moment where it seems as if we are romanticizing young people. Mm-hmm. And I'm deeply concerned about that. And I want us to remember that yes, young people may see the world a bit differently, but we can't necessarily forget that they are still living with the so-called old people. And if we're talking about 14-year-olds, it's the 20-year-olds that are old people. Mm. It's the 25-year-olds that are old people, and then all ages above that. Mm-hmm. And since they still exist on Earth, like I don't want us to get so caught up in the idea that, oh, young people don't see whatever, that we forget that by the time they end up in my classroom, the stuff that they say out of their mouth is actually insane.
Yes.
And crazy. And worse yet, because they are somehow unchurched or have grown up in this multicultural age, they actually have no perspective on what
true.
It is that they've just
this is
said.
Very
exactly.
So I can have a student who sees the word Negro and says nigger and says, that's the way I thought it was pronounced.
Mm.
You know, and say that in class like it was
wait a
normal.
Minute. Read so, it? They read the word?
Like, yeah, read N-E-G-R-O.
And said nigger?
Yes.
Now, that's a deeper problem.
Maybe so.
That is a much deeper problem.
But we need phonics there.
Maybe so.
Phonics.
Maybe so. But the
because
point
I'm
is,
confused.
She had, there was no moment of pause for her in that moment. There was no, she read it three times and was like,
what?
Anyways, I don't necessarily want to get caught up on that, but I think that
before
we end up trying to send the 20 and over club out to pasture, I think what we need to remember is that young people still exist within these frameworks that we're talking about.
Right.
Young
right.
people are still growing up within these frameworks that do privilege Black boys' lives over Black girls' lives.
Yeah.
And I think that what we have to remember as this movement or these movements gain additional traction is to, I guess, return to the Reverend's point but to go back to an earlier point that these are systems that we are dealing with, and I think that has to be our approach. We have to kind of take those moments to look at the bigger connections.
That's why I came to you, Dr. Bynum. I knew you can wrap it up. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to continue with our cultural roundtable. We're going to talk about Laverne Cox. We're going to talk about Caitlyn Jenner. We're going to talk about the correct way to pronounce Negro. This is KY's Whitehead in for Mark Steiner here on WEAA 88.9 FM. On our way to break, we're hearing Through the Wire by Kanye West. Today is his birthday, born today in 1977. We'll be back soon. Stay tight.
Understand how I feel right now, man. It's your boy Kanye Titter. Shutdown, what's going on? Yeah. I drink a goose for breakfast, an insure for dessert. Somebody order pancakes.
I'm here talking to Reverend Merrick Moise. I'm talking to Dr. Tara Bynum. I'm talking to Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love the Poet, and Kalima Young. And we're trying to deconstruct what is happening around the country. I do want to mention, before we start talking about Caitlyn Jenner, what happened with Kalief Browder. I think it's important just to put his name out here.
Mm-hmm.
Over the weekend, The New Yorker reported the news about the suicide of 22-year-old Kalief Browder. He was 16 years old when he was arrested, and he was held without being charged or tried on Rikers Island for 3 years, with two of these 3 years in solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. When the story first broke in The New Yorker, he talked about it, and video later confirmed how he was beaten and tortured. When he got out of Rikers Island, there was concerns that he felt that the police were following him, people were watching him. time. He was in and off of paranoid drugs. He was thinking that something was going to happen to him, and he finally committed suicide. So this speaks to a bigger issue, not just about the ways in which we need to reform the prison complex, what they call our new Jim Crow, but the ways in which we help young people adjust to being back at home or even keep them out of these situations. 3 years without being charged or tried. Kalima, can you speak to this before we move on?
In what way? I'm sorry.
Well, this notion that we're talking about, how do we help young people to deal with this situation? Here is a young boy mm-hmm. who was taken to prison. Mm-hmm. No charges filed. That's against the Constitution. Mm-hmm. 3 years held. Mm-hmm. He came out, and of course there was a spiral that took place. Are there things that we can do within this system to kind of be a catch net for our young boys?
I think for young people in general, we need to understand that they are actually humans.
Right.
With thoughts and feelings and desires and needs, and to treat them as such. And sort of speaking to this larger issue, young people are not allowed a childhood, especially African-American children mm-hmm. are not allowed a childhood. There's been a statistic that came out that said that people generally add 4 extra years onto a young person. Mm-hmm. A young black person's body. Mm-hmm. So at 7-year-old is actually 10 or 12.
Wow.
And if we don't see the humanity and the fact that young black children are children and treat them as such and cherish them as such, mm-hmm. These sad situations are going to continue to go forward. And also that we actually have to have a really strong conversation in the black community in general around mental health,
right?
Around psychological health, around intergenerational trauma, around how we deal with trauma and post-traumatic slave syndrome. Mm. We need to have like actual support systems in place. Lots of people say, yeah, go to church. Church is one, having faith is one level of uplift. Mm. But there's something to be said for actually really paying attention to the mental health of people.
The preacher needs a therapist.
That's real.
Can we put that on a shirt?
I like that. Right. The preacher needs a therapy. But I think that reaches to a bigger point, Reverend Merrick, that we were talking about in the first part of this segment, the ways in which we can heal around this and the ways in which we approach healing. I thought what was interesting, you said earlier about this generation of unchurched people, as well as what Dr. Bynum said, let's not go down the road of thinking young people are above what's happening in society and they're growing up within these frameworks that we have set up. With that in mind, let's turn our discussion just a little bit and talk about Caitlyn Jenner. Let's talk about Call Me Caitlyn and this introduction of the Vanity Fair cover of Bruce Jenner's transformation into Caitlyn Jenner. And there were some mixed reactions to this. You talked a little bit about this, Merrick, this idea that some people felt it was more about white privilege getting on the cover of Vanity Fair than celebrating trans women.
I literally just came back yesterday from the Philadelphia Trans Health Conference, and so this was a big topic this weekend. And pretty much, you know, it's great that this person has been able to do this after having living 65 years,
yeah,
literally in a proverbial closet, and it was just and has had a big life, right? And that, like I said, like her money is really long money. That being said, on an average, most transgender people do not have the resources it takes to do what she did. And I think that
let me just stop you there. When you said to do what she did, in the way in which she did it, because when you talk about Vanity Fair, you talk about Annie Leibovitz. It's a whole different level of introducing yourself to the world than I believe that most trans people would go to.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of the way in which she did it and the medical care she has received to present herself in such a way.
Okay.
I mean, I know brothers right now, trans men who are struggling to even get testosterone, even to see an endocrinologist to get approved to start their hormone therapy if that's what they choose to do. And so, you know, it's really, it's a very interesting moment. Brother Teek Milan, a phenomenal writer, advocate, said that we need to Kanye this moment. And he said, well, what does that – people like, well, what does that mean? He said, Caitlyn, I'm going to let you finish, but – Caitlyn, I'm going to let you finish, but most trans women of color particularly are facing dire odds out here in terms of unemployment, in terms of threats to their physical body, in terms of harassment. And I think that this is an opportunity for the community to talk about itself in a holistic way. But I'm loath to, you know, turn this microscope on Ms. Jenner, because she is living her life. And actually, on Diane Sawyer, I heard that she said, well, I'm the real story of the Kardashians. The next check is going to be a big check. Meanwhile, we've got trans women all over the country, particularly here in Baltimore, that have been murdered, and we don't know who did it, why they did it, and it's unsolved.
Well, can you talk about that as well, that this notion that perhaps is this a missed opportunity by focusing the spotlight so closely on Caitlyn Jenner and by extension the Kardashian family again, are we missing the opportunity to talk about what's happening in the trans community?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And that's tailor-made just for that. Mm. It's sensationalized, and it's now a big part of pop culture. And what Caitlyn has done. And I think that it's sad. It's sad because there's a story there. There's a reason why he or she now would go so slowly with this transition. I mean, you're talking about when Caitlyn was Bruce, Olympian.
Yeah.
You know, that's an Olympian, you know, who has done many great things, whose life then became a reality show with a woman who came to fame from her dead husband and her
child
who came to fame in a home porn video.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Right. So there are a lot of levels to this.
Yes.
And then you have this man who is emasculated on TV. His wife said that she wanted to change her last name back to Kardashian while she has two Jenner children and a whole husband.
Right.
You know, that there's a lot
right
to this. And so it's sad because if Bruce were able at the time when he did the interview to talk about what he has experienced and what has made him go, you know, made him want to remain closeted,
right,
number one, and now all of a sudden feel so liberated, I think his story would genuinely speak to a lot of stories that people actually have, like real people actually have every day. But I also want to say this. In the LGBTQ community, we have this whole gay rights movement and everything. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that as well. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that because the gay white male has finally felt like they do not belong.
Mm.
No movement in this country occurs without a white man saying it's okay for it to occur, or without it being funded by a certain, you know, a mass. What I'm saying is a mass movement.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah,
a mass movement.
And I understand it. So, who's actually behind?
Right,
this
right. So gay rights, that whole thing is a gay white male movement because finally they felt like they were uncomfortable. Somebody's treating me wrong, so let me just do this and get my rights. But now you have this transgendered white male who is now a woman. And I'm saying that is how he has always felt. So
right,
we're going to go with that. That's fine. But I also posted on Facebook this because people, their sentiments are absolutely crazy to me. I mean, didn't Cher's daughter turned into was a transgender.
Yes, Chaz Bono.
Chaz Bono.
Right.
This was not.
This
is not the first time it's happened. You
right
know, but that's a woman.
Right.
You know, a woman going to being a male. You know, so this is a whole other thing.
But you also think of the fact that he's a triathlete. I mean, you're
right. That's what I'm saying. You're talking about
around
a very.
Yeah.
You know, this gentleman has prestige in this country.
Yeah.
He's on the cover of a Wheaties box.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the quintessential white male.
Yeah, so you're talking about a man who at one point in time was on the cover of a Wheaties box, and now is a woman on the cover of Vanity Fair. This is
in
not
one
crazy
lifetime.
In one
lifetime.
And this
in
is not
lifetime
crazy. You have to understand where he is and where she is now, where he was.
Well, let me get a caller in here because
okay,
Michael wants to talk a little bit about what's happening in the community as well. Michael?
Yes, how are you?
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for this great dialogue. There are a couple of things that I did want to address, but one of them was just to make sure that we do honor those gender identities and use the proper pronouns.
Okay.
And even, you know, so in that, you know, make sure that we do honor them. Even, and I know we're talking freely, so it's kind of like we're just flowing, but I did want to address that. But one of the key things I did want to point out was the fact that when we talk about the trans movement, if you will, was started by two black trans women, well, actually one Latina and the other black woman, Marsha P. and Ms. Rivera. Mm-hmm. And so that was hijacked by gay white males to then arrive in the position that they're in now regarding their rights and so forth and so on. So we're at a pivotal moment, yes, in the trans movement where we have to congregate it because this was started by queer black women taking a stand in who they were regardless of what the society said they should be based on body parts. So that's very critical. And I think that it is time for black communities to start this discussion and engage in it very deeply from all angles, including the spiritual piece, because it is within our beliefs, our indigenous belief systems. We do understand those who are body in one way, but spirit identified as other.
Right.
So when we go there, we will then find ourselves, and then the community can then come together and reconcile a lot, which then brings us into not male-female, but more so feminine-masculine principle.
Right.
And I also look at how the gay, when we look at how the white male has been disconnected from that feminine principle. So here we see what that looks like when masculinity is not balanced. And so we see Laverne Cox and we see the other trans women of color bolstered into media, and then media dictates and controls the way in which she is portrayed. However, Caitlyn has the ability to control the way in which she is portrayed. Mm-hmm. That's why we see it in that term. So we do have to stand as a community, as a whole, and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. We are going to kind of be the moment. But also on a deeper level, when we look at the black trans masculine community,
all right,
those
Michael.
That were born, you know, female bodied, but then identify as male, that community has not been heard at all. And that is a direct link to that black female body. So we need to look at what that looks like when we look at reproductive justice, when we look at health care access, and then the queer communities who say, I'm not binary at all. Mm-hmm. I exist and you will see me. Those communities are just hushed and swept under the rug. So we have to look at this on another level and go deeper and say, why isn't that community? So we have Blake Robinson that just committed suicide in North Carolina in March. This young man has been an activist. He chose to live with a foster family so that he could survive the trauma of the system. And was in a student at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and committed suicide. So we have to look at those things. We have brothers from way back, Alexander Goodrum, who committed suicide in the mental hospital, who had done work out in Arizona. We have Marcellus Daniels Cook, who committed suicide. So we do have to look at the mental health piece. We have to look like what isolation feels like in black masculinity. We also need to look at masculine central women who are carrying this masculine principle and not being able to survive in this piece. So it's a lot that we have to, as we say, unpack.
Excellent.
So I think that as a community, we do have to rally around and just basically not even put the energy in calling this person's name.
Okay. Oh, because, you know what, Michael, I'm going to stop you there. Thank you so much for your comment. There's
that's my
a
mentor,
lot
by
there.
The way.
That's your
oh,
mentor?
Hey.
I'm just going to say, while you were talking, Reverend Merrick, I mean, he was running around just clapping and screaming here. But you raised a lot of issues, but I think we want to spend a little time kind of unpacking them before we end up the show, because he talked about Laverne Cox.
Yes.
And just to know, Laverne Cox from Orange is a New Black. But she noted that for trans women of color, one of the biggest issues that they are dealing with is violence.
Oh, yes.
She said in the first 8 weeks of 2015, 7 transgendered women were murdered. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you're talking homelessness, lack of health care, and nobody is talking about it. Even though Laverne Cox was on the cover of Time magazine, how can we take the issues of trans women of color and put them and remove Caitlyn Jenner, in a sense, out of the center of the discussion and put those issues there, Reverend Merrick?
I think that we're already doing that, and I think that one of the things that we need to do, particularly in spaces like this and even on national media, is continue to switch the narrative. Like, Caitlyn Jenner's stories is one of many stories.
Okay, okay.
And so what does the life of a trans woman in different parts of the country look like? A trans woman was just killed in Philadelphia not too long ago, maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Her murderer was caught, but that's a very rare thing. And so now we have to look at why their lives are in such danger. And oftentimes people are forced into the survival economy of the street, which puts them at danger. And when we talk about Mia Hall, who was killed at NSA, she was involved involved in survival economy systems,
which
put her in a precarious position. And oftentimes, trans women do not want to be there, but they have to survive. Mm-hmm. I met many trans women who now they have that good government job, but they'll be very frank and say, I had to do X to get to Y because I had no agency. Okay. And so when we start, and then we also have to start talking about, we don't live in the gay ghettos. Trans people mm-hmm. are not in necessarily in Mount Vernon. I don't have an apartment in Mount Vernon. No shade to anybody who does, but we are in among our people, and we always have been. So a lot of this conversation also has to talk, we also have to deal with how we exist in Black communities, how we exist in our Black bodies, and the impact that we have. You know, a lot of people forget, you know, that Stonewall was a riot, right? Started by Marsha P. and Sylvia Rivera. So when I see white LGBT people say, well, why are you burning down your own community? I'm like, you weren't complaining when you were marching down the Charles Street last year in celebration of a riot.
Right.
And so the intersectionality, once again, with Black bodies, with gender identities that have always been there. And as Van Michael was saying, this is in our indigenous religious traditions, particularly in the Yoruba system, where you have deities that are male and female and exist in the same space at the same time.
Exactly.
And how if the Orisha, right, are mirrors of ourselves, then we, in some aspects, we mirror that. We mirror these gender identities.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Even in that, you're speaking about Yoruba and other traditions and other religious practices, and you're talking to a lot of Black people in the Black community are Christian, who will look at that and be like, I don't want no part. I don't know what you mean. What does that mean? What is that you got there? Sage? What is sage? I don't want no parts of that. You know, incense.
Right.
What is that? You know, and I'm being kind of funny,
but in reality,
that's the truth. And then it goes back to me saying about us being a very conservative society.
Right. And what I would say to that, when Christians say that, I say, well, Paul says there's no male or female in Christ.
Mm.
So if we're talking about that, so how do I meet my brother who is a man of transgender experience when I know that there's no male or female in Christ? Aren't we supposed to be equal? And oftentimes we don't get to that because we get polarized by these things and definitions that oftentimes comes outside of our cultural lens that have been put upon us, and we've adopted it to survive here. But sometimes the stuff we adopt, it don't work no more. The shoes I wore at 2 don't fit me now that I'm 41.
And I also,
we want to get to a phone call.
I want to say something real quick.
Okay.
I do want to say this. It is based in understanding. I might be messing up the pronouns at certain points because I don't have full understanding. Yes, I'm a lesbian woman, but I am a woman. I feel like I am a woman. You know what I mean? And so I might not understand. And I think that across the board is an issue. People do not understand what they hate and fear what they don't know. And that, I think it's like we need to go like elementary school steps, like explaining what that means. What is transgendered, cisgendered, this, you know, what are those things? What are the definitions of these things? How do I address you now? You know, how do I refer to you when I knew you 4 years ago? I might not know that. I think the general public might not know that. And also, physically, people need to understand something. There's no black and white. You have people who are born hermaphrodite. You have people who are physically dual gendered, physically intersect. So if there is no black and white in the physical world, what makes you think there is black and white in the metaphysical world?
Well, these are bigger issues. These are much bigger issues than we have to be able to unpack in our last 5 minutes.
Sorry.
When we start talking about, you know, this notion of who we are and how we identify ourselves, as well as just confronting this piece. Is it really hate and fear, or is it just you just don't understand it?
But
I mean, these terms like transgender,
not cisgender,
in so many ways, these are not terms that I grew up with.
Right.
So as I'm learning cisgender, like I'm just learning what that means. I'm like, I get it now. Okay, that's me. So now then, what's trans? Gendered and trying to understand. So it's really about trying to educate. I want to get to Breonna Jenkins because she wants to give a perspective of a trans woman of color, and then I want to bring it around so that every member of the panel can begin to wrap this up so we can close our conversation. Breonna, you got just 30 seconds. Your comment, please.
I just want to say, as a trans activist here in Baltimore, how it's very important for our allies, for those of our cisgender members, especially here in Baltimore City, to really be allies and demonstrate allyship by bringing trans people of color into the room, into the table, and help to kind of reverse the erasure that has gone on, especially in this city, concerning a lot of the trans murders, the trans harassment from the police. So, you know, some of what you can do is be intentional in bringing us to the table, right, so we can create visibility for ourselves, and we can tell people who we are and what our needs are. And I just want to say, July 24th, 2015, Black Trans Uprising Rally in March.
Thank you so much, Reverend Merrick Moise. He's an ordained minister, writer, community activist, and teacher, one of the first African Americans ordained within the old Catholic movement in Baltimore. Dr. Tara Bynum is assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University. Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love the Poet, who's doing an open mic at Mondawmin on Saturday, indie spoken word artist and musician and author of Black Marks on White Paper, and Kalima Young, director of the Baltimore Art Plus Justice Project, a project of the Office of Community Engagement at the Maryland Institute College of Art. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Marbranis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern and day in history research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wall Matthews of Clean Cuts. And I am Dr. K-Wise Whitehead in for Mark Steiner. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Chan displayed a part of a herd at a show. Pops prints the piece on his jeans or the bowls. But let the herd know if beef they want to throw. Lunches of punches is what I bestow. Oodles of O's and has my hoes and my checks. O's take the shape of medallions and specs. Don't forget.